Welcome to the Birthful Podcast. I'm Adriana Losada, and today's show is about protecting your perineum during birth. The thought of vaginal tearing can make any person cringe, and let's not even think about episiotomies. Are there ways to avoid tearing? What's the evidence behind perineal massage, Kegels, and squats? Will being told how to push make things worse? Rachel Reed is here to tell us more. Stay tuned. This episode of Birthful is brought to you by CanvasPeople.com, a super easy-to-use photo-to-canvas service that helps you get your favorite photos off your phone and onto your walls. Use the unique promo code BIRTHFUL to get a free 11x14 canvas. All you pay for is shipping. Learn more at CanvasPeople.com. This episode of Birthful is also brought to you by Simply Breastfeeding, a prenatal breastfeeding course to help nursing parents feel confident with their newborns. Learn more at birthful.com/simplybreastfeeding and use the code BIRTHFUL for 15% off. The Birthful Podcast, talking to maternity pros and new parents. Hello, mighty parents and parents-to-be. Thanks again for all the love you give the show and for telling your friends about it and for sharing it with your clients if you're a doula and for putting it on your list of best podcasts to listen to if you're a blogger. All the things that are happening. I'm super excited. Thank you. I really, really appreciate it. If you like what you hear, then make sure you subscribe so you don't miss a thing. And to best support this podcast, please support its sponsors, who in today's case are Canvas People and Simply Breastfeeding. Also, pregnant people, if you've only prepared for the having a birth part, then you're halfway there. You need to also prepare for the having a baby part. Let me help you with that. Let me help you make the first few weeks with your newborn so much easier. Go to birthfulcourses.com so you can sign up for my Thrive with Your Newborn online postpartum preparation classes. And then you can stop worrying that you won't know what to do when you take your baby home and how to connect with that baby and how to understand that baby and how to figure out all the identity shifts that are happening in yourself going from, becoming a parent, and also what to do to make your relationship work as a team and not be at each other's throats. All the things. Even the class is set up for 5 weeks, you do get all the content right away and you can review it at any point. So yeah, go do it. Sign up now at birthfulcourses.com. All right. My guest for today's renewed episode is the fantastic Dr. Rachel Reed, who is a senior lecturer and discipline leader in midwifery at the University of the Sunshine Coast in Australia. She has provided midwifery care for hundreds of women in a range of settings in the UK and in Australia. And Rachel is a writer and presenter. She's also the author of the amazing blog Midwife Thinking at midwifethinking.com, which I recommend you add to your reading list. And Rachel also has a freshly birthed new book called Why Induction Matters, which I cannot wait to read. Rachel and I first talked not that long after I started doing the podcast, and she shared such relevant information that I felt we needed to dust this one off because more people need to hear what she had to say. I've updated the links on the show notes and made sure everything is going to the right place, and even got a new updated photo for Rachel, so there you go. All brand new. Okay, here we go. Rachel, welcome. So happy to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed listening to the podcast, so it's exciting to be invited on.
Yay. And that's one of the things that makes me blush, that you even knew about the podcast before. So yay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So today we're going to be talking about protecting the perineum. And as a doula childbirth educator, I get a lot of questions about tears. You know, this is the thing that many moms think about. What if I tear? What if I need an episiotomy? So, and then they start thinking, what can I do to prevent that? And I get asked about perineal massage. And then there's the debate about Kegels and now Kegels versus squats and all of that. So let's break this down into steps. And I was thinking we would first go with Captain Obvious and agree that the best way to protect your perineum is to steer clear of an episiotomy, right? The evidence is pretty clear that routine episiotomies are unnecessary, and that even ACOG has a recommendation against doing unnecessary and routine episiotomies. But in your experience, what would be a case when, if any, when an episiotomy is needed?
Well, I think I'm hoping that the practice of episiotomy to protect the perineum is outdated now. I know it still happens in some places, but doing an episiotomy is the biggest risk factor for a significant tear. So most practitioners want to avoid that and won't do it. The only times that I've only done three episiotomies in my entire career, and they have been for fetal distress. So a situation where this baby needs to come out now, and the only way to get it out is to do an episiotomy. I have never done one for the perineum. I have spoken to midwives who talk about a situation called buttonholing, where the perineum can start to kind of break down, little holes appear. I have never seen this happen, so I feel I can't comment on that, but I know midwives have said in that circumstance they would do an episiotomy just to minimise the buttonholing and lots of buttonhole tears and have one tear instead. So, but I can't comment on that because I've never seen that happen.
Wow, and that's something I have never heard about. So, wow. I didn't even know that was a thing.
No, it's obviously rare because I've never seen it and I've only heard about it a few times.
Mm-hmm. So I think the first recommendation is to the listeners out there to please ask their birth providers about their episiotomy rates and know that there's very clear evidence that that is something that should be extremely low if done at all. So that's one obvious. You've got the research behind you. That's one obvious way of trying to avoid instant, predetermined tearing or lacerations, I guess, because it wouldn't be a tear, it would be cut. Well, now that that's out of the way, if you were to say, Rachel, that, you know, what would be the ideal condition of a perineum that what you would like to see in a perineum in birth so that it wouldn't tend to tear? Are we talking about a tone perineum, a tight perineum? Does it matter? What do you think?
Well, every woman, we are designed to birth. Our perineal tissues are designed to stretch. They're actually designed to tear and to heal. So, but I know it's a huge fear for women. There are factors antenatally that increase your chance of tearing. So obviously a bigger baby, there's a bigger amount of stretch that the perineum has to do during birth. And women who have gained a lot of weight in the pregnancy, and that's probably something to do with the tissues. Higher socioeconomic groups, which is an interesting finding. I think that's linked to women who can afford private healthcare. So they're getting private obstetricians who have much higher rates of episiotomy. Smoking, anything that, if you think about, the perineum is made up of tissue, which is part of the body. So anything that can improve the nutrition, so think zinc, vitamin C for skin, silica, vitamin K, anything that will provide good nutrition to those tissues will help to prepare them for birth. There's perineal massage and this is for women who are having their first baby. If they doing a perineal massage, or it's called massage, but it's actually more like stretching. It sounds very pleasant when you say massage, and it's not necessarily pleasant. That's been found to reduce the chance of tearing for women having their first baby. And some women choose to do that. The women I care for, I offer that, I talk about it, but I don't feel they need to do it because the perineum, as you're getting up to birth, you've got all these hormones that make it really soft and stretchy. You've got increased discharge, so that helps to stretch. It's all getting ready to stretch and birth a baby, so you don't really need to do anything. But if a woman feels like she wants to do something to build trust in her body, then perineal massage is an option. There's YouTubes on how to do that. If you do, Penny Simpkin has a YouTube explaining how to do it. Mm-hmm. So that's an option. I found tends to be women who are having VBACs, actually, who find that really helpful because they can feel their tissues stretching, and it just helps to build that trust because as the pregnancy moves on, they can feel more stretch during their massage, and that can help confidence. So that's an option in pregnancy.
Okay. Yep. So Yeah, so if it's something that they, but if they're not feeling it and not thinking, you know, it starts becoming like a chore and it's not helping their confidence, would you say don't bother with it? Or
yeah, and I don't care really whether women do it or not. I don't think it makes that much of a difference during the birth, because you think about this research, when they do research, you've got to look at the populations they're researching on, and they're probably researching on populations of women who are birthing in mixed contexts with mixed practitioners, with all kinds of other risk factors thrown in for tearing during the birth process, which the women I'm working with aren't necessarily going to be having. So, and I've also found, you know, women don't tear, and they've done no perineal massage, and some women have done perineal massage and torn. It really is up to the woman. It's mm-hmm. It's definitely not a must to do. It's an option. And I would warn against the epino. So there's now devices that are designed to stretch the perineum antenatally.
I was just going to ask you about that. If we could talk for a moment about the epino childbirth and pelvic floor trainer.
Yes. And I guess my biggest concern about the epino is once again, kind of giving women the message that they are not enough, that they have to do something in order to prepare for something, which is actually a physiological process that doesn't need preparation. Your body knows how to prepare without having to buy a product to do it. And the epino will work in the same way the massage will work, as it will stretch the perineal tissues, and for women having their first baby, it'll reduce the chance of tearing slightly. However, with the epino, it actually goes into the vagina and opens up to almost the size of a head of a baby by the time you've kind of trained your perineum to do this. There is no long-term research on what that does to the muscles in the pelvis. Yes, it probably does reduce tearing, because by the time you give birth, you've essentially given birth numerous times and your pelvic floor's been stretched. But we don't have any really good research about long-term outcomes. There have also been injuries, women tearing themselves using the device.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
Yeah. So Queensland Health, if anybody's interested in kind of looking at a hospital's kind of focus on it, Queensland Health have just done some guidelines. And if you do the Queensland Health maternity guidelines, they'll come up about perineums. And they actually warn against epinos, saying, yeah, that there's concerns about the tearing yourself and that they shouldn't be recommended.
Yeah, because from what I understood when I looked at the website, it has you insert this into your vagina and slowly, you know, sort of pump it so that it gets bigger. And they mentioned something like in 3 weeks you will get to be able to have that idealized 10 centimeters, which is presumably the size of a baby's head. And that 10 centimeters, really. And thinking of, I read through your blog as well, and you were saying you're concerned about, you know, constantly stretching to that size over and over again. Like you said, your perineum is not really supposed to be doing that often.
No, if you give birth to multiple babies, you usually have a space between them. You're not kind of birthing three babies in 1 week, which is potentially what you're doing, what you're mimicking with this device.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
But I know, having said that, I have actually looked after a woman who used it and found it really helpful and was, you know, very happy with it. And I know that a lot of women do use it and feel that it works for them. It's something they can focus on, and they're the kind of women who like to have gadgets and like to, and that it works. But it's not something I would recommend. But at the same time, if women feel that that's useful for them,
and make their informed choices and decide on it. Yeah, and if it gives them confidence, for sure. Have you found, as a side note, that then they need more sort of recovery PT, or can they use this or a different gadget to tone back or strengthen their perineum again? I'm assuming that it stretches it more than usual.
It is designed to then be used as a tool to get tone back into the pelvic floor. The woman, I've only looked after one woman who used it that I know of, mm-hmm. And she had an intact perineum, but then she also had a birth that probably would have resulted in an intact perineum anyway. And she didn't notice anything postnatally. You know, nothing came up. But it was...
So it worked for her? Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Well, we will... I will step back. I feel bad laughing about it, but just the...
No, I laugh about it. I laughed about
we
it.
We apologize for laughing.
But really, it's doing the same thing as perineal massage, so... Mm-hmm. You can not buy the product and save some money and do perineal massage if that's something that you're wanting to do. And those guidelines I mentioned actually talk about when to do it, 35 weeks, and how often to do it, 3 times a fortnight. So it gives a bit of a guide as to if you're going to do it, how to do it.
Have you seen any research or any evidence for, say, using something like coconut oil, or instead of a perineal massage, just the application to keep the skin more subtle? Does that make any difference?
And there hasn't been any research on that. And again, the body produces lots of fluid at the end of pregnancy. As anyone who's been pregnant noticed, it's quite juicy and stretchy down there anyway. I don't think we need to add additional oils. Mm-hmm. But again, if that's something women want to do as part of their preparation and building self-trust, then coconut oil will be a nice one to use.
Okay. Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back and talk about, you know, what to do for labor. We'll be right back. We all have our favorite photos. You know, the ones we cherish and adore them. So here's a question. Wouldn't you love to see those special photos that are sitting on your phone or computer displayed on your walls? For some reason, every summer, we do a big overhaul of my daughter's bedroom, getting rid of outgrown clothes, unused toys, just updating the style to her age. So this summer, she wanted to have some very nice, unique prints on her wall, and I didn't want to pay a fortune. That's when Canvas people came in. We took a gorgeous image of the night sky with a silhouetted tree that she loved and wrote the inspirational message she wanted on top of it. A few simple steps later, it was uploaded and ordered, and now it's decorating her room in a very special and unique way that resonates with her. Thank you, Canvas people. Canvas People transforms your photos into beautiful, unique, museum-quality canvases that are easy to hang and make fabulous home decor. I know you're going to love Canvas People, and I have a special code that you can use to get an 11 by 14 Canvas People print for free. This is a $69.99 value, and all you do is pay for the shipping and handling. So to get your own 11 by 14 canvas, just visit canvaspeople.com and use my special code, which is BIRTHFUL. Again, that's BIRTHFUL, and take advantage of this special limited offer for BIRTHFUL listeners right now, because it won't be around forever. So to get your free print, go to canvaspeople.com today and use the code BIRTHFUL. And we're back talking with Rachel Reed about protecting your perineum. So then let's get to women are in their late pregnancy, nice and juicy and stretchy, and then labor starts during birth. What are the things that they can, let's start first with the risk that would increase the risk of tearing.
So the things that increase the chances of tearing is probably no surprise. Induction of labor, so using a syntocinon infusion, especially for women who have previously had babies, increases the chance of tearing. Really, the baby needs to be born slowly and the tissues need to have time to stretch. So anything that interferes with that, so syntocinon can push that baby through too quickly before the tissues have stretched. So can directed pushing. So women being told to hold their breath and push, that increases the chance of tearing. People, episiotomy, obviously, we've talked about. People pulling babies. So when the baby's head's out, practitioners will often then grasp the baby's head and pull the baby's shoulder into the posterior wall of the vagina as they pull the baby out, which can tear the posterior wall of the vagina. Positions. So the position, any position that increases the tension in the pelvic floor and the perineum. So squatting, lithotomy. I kind of describe it as anything that when the perineum needs a bit of bagginess in it to stretch, and if you kind of tighten it by opening your legs really wide, then that can increase the chance of tearing, because the pressure of the baby's head coming through that really stretched tissue is more likely to tear. and hands-on. So for a long time, I've had practitioners. I was taught, I dread to think what I did to women. The way that I was taught to manage a birth, and it very much was manage in quotes, was direct the woman pushing. So she'd be told how to push because I couldn't possibly trust her to push a baby out herself. And then I would be putting my hand on her perineum, thinking that that was actually protecting the perineum. And then I'd put my hand on the baby's head as it came out to slow down the birth and again protect a perineum and then pull the baby out. And this is what I was taught you needed to do to protect a perineum. And that's still common practice. And midwives who are used to doing that are frightened not to do it often when I talk to them about, well, you know, the research actually shows that increases the chance of perineal trauma and pain. They can't get, there was one small study that wasn't very well done and has been critiqued, I think it was the 80s, that showed that hands on versus just hands off and letting the baby birth didn't do anything in terms of reducing the chance of tearing, but women on day 10 reported more pain on a pain scale, perineal pain, if the midwife had not had her hands on. So from that, we've created this culture, you have to be hands on because it'll reduce tearing, which is never what, that is not what the research said. And then since then, we have got good research saying, no, hands on can increase the chance of tearing and can increase the chance of hemorrhage after the birth.
And that's I see it all the time. I do. I mean, except for, I guess, in home births, in a hospital setting, there is an immediate of trying to stretch, like perineal massage as the baby is crowning and with lube or with like a soapy substance as well. You know, and all these things that you described of managing that exit of the baby, putting the hands on it. Like I see so much of it.
It's still common practice. There are a lot of midwives in hospitals not doing it. I mean, I teach students, so I get to find out what's going on in their placement areas. And most midwives and obstetricians are still doing that hands-on that you've seen. We don't, in Australia, it's not perineal massaging while the baby's being born. That's not, I don't think that's ever been a thing. But there are practitioners doing hands-off. And what women need to remember is practitioners are humans and they have fear and concern. And from their perspective, they're thinking, if I don't do this and this woman tears, then that's my fault. And often the perineum, and I wrote that in my blog post, is almost like a badge of honor to the practitioner. So, you know, you'll hear midwives saying, oh, and she had an 8-pound baby and her perineum was intact. And other midwives will say, well done to the midwife. You know, as if the midwife had anything to do with the woman's perineum. And, you know, if then a woman has a significant tear, you know, there's all this, oh, I wonder what midwife did. Did she protect the perineum? And you know, I've had students involved where women have had third-degree tears. So you've got first and second. First-degree tear is just the mucosa. Second-degree tear is involving the muscle. Third-degree tear is very deep muscle and some of the sphincter they call the parts of the sphincter, the, what are they called? Fibers, that's it. And then a fourth degree tear actually goes into the anal sphincter. So I've had student midwives be involved in third degree tears and then be devastated because they've been questioned as to what they did with their hands when the baby was being born and how they stopped the tear. Why didn't they stop the tear? When there is enough research now for us to know that nothing that we do with our hands during the birth is going to reduce the chance of this woman tearing. In fact, it might increase the chance. So if we're putting things onto the perineum, like ointments or whatever you were talking about, we're one, disrupting the microbiome of the vagina, which is, and I've listened to the podcast about it, it was great. The vaginal discharge at that point is primed, ready with all this beautiful microbiome, all this bacteria ready for the baby. And you're interfering with that. You're putting chemicals on that can interfere with that. And you're pressing on the tissues, you can create edema in the tissues, which will increase the chance of tearing. It's a cultural thing. And most practices that care providers do are cultural and they're not evidence-based. And it's then very difficult to shift that because of the beliefs that are behind the practices that they're doing. And I was there. I was terrified to not put my hands on and I had to slowly just back off.
So what made you start to take your hands off and change your perspective?
It was mostly what the hospital I was working in when I was a newly qualified student, a newly qualified midwife, was implementing water birth. And as part of the, and actually water birth reduces the chance of tearing. And as part of that, we were told you mustn't touch the baby as it comes out. You mustn't touch the woman. You just don't touch. And that was such a huge, what? How can we not touch? It's going to be awful. Things are going to happen. You know, cords are going to be around babies' necks. Women's perineums are going to explode. And that didn't happen. These babies came out and it was like, oh. So then I just started to think, well, if that's the case in water, then why is it different outside of water? And then I kind of looked at all the research that was already saying you're not protecting the perineum, even though you might feel you are. And I just stopped one thing at a time. So I took my hands off the baby's head for a few births, and then took my hands off the perineum for a few births, and then stopped pulling the baby out. And it took me about 6 months to work backwards from fiddling on during birth and interfering to doing nothing unless needed. And then you start to learn when you do need to do things, because your default is not doing it. So you see physiology, and then you can recognize pathology. And for a woman, for example, who's had an epidural, then you do need to maybe put your hand on the baby's head if the baby's birthing very quickly, because she's not getting that feedback from her body to slow the birth down herself. So you learn that. And you also get to watch women birthing instinctively and realize that they're actually protecting their perineums. They're doing all the things that reduce the chance of tearing if you just shut up and leave them alone. You know, they'll be pushing, and then as that baby's head starts to stretch their perineum, and what I've noticed actually is women tend to, they might get into a squat for pushing, some will, but once that baby's head gets really to the point of stretching, they'll often move into an all four position. They will close their legs, because it's stretching and it's uncomfortable. Anyone who's had that sensation, it's not something that you kind of, it's not something that you want to push and make stronger. So women try and stop the birth almost. They'll close their legs. They'll stop adding weight to their pushing. They'll kind of go, oh, ow, ow, and they'll even like say, ow, 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 ow. And some will even try and push their babies back in. I've had one of my friends recently, well, a few years back, did that at her birth, and said, I didn't want to push the baby back in. I said, well, good luck, you do that. So women will do all of these things that essentially are protecting their perineums. And yet as midwives or the care practitioners, we're then working against that by saying, open your legs, give the baby lots of room, you know, take your hands away, let me put my hands there. So I started to realize that actually women have got it sorted themselves if they're birthing instinctively and they're not being told what to do, and we're not doing things to them, and they're in that real zone where they're tuned into what's happening with their baby and their body, and not having to focus on what's going on in the room around them.
Well, and the tough part also is that independently of whether the care provider is managing the birth of the baby, the exit of the baby, usually, and depends on the practice, of course, but there's a lot of directed pushing, and there's a lot of, it's such a precise script, and I don't know how it is in Australia, but here, I mean, I can recite the script specifically of, you know, grab behind your knees and bring them up to your ears and tuck your chin and curl around your baby and hold your breath and count to 10 and give it all you've got. And there's a time, you know, it's like there's a rush to get this baby out as soon as possible, and this mom just needs to really give it her all and be exhausted, or else. So if she's doing those things, also she's not feeling in tune with the process itself, and kind of you get it feels like you're getting a self-fulfilling prophecy circle of, you push this way, so I have to manage it, then manage it, so you push this way, and so forth.
It is. And then you're actually creating all these conditions that increase the chance of tearing. A woman on her back, woman with her legs wide open, directed pushing, right down, and it's, you know, down into your bottom, exactly where all that pressure is. The pelvis can't move to open up when she's sat on her sacrum on it, or lying on her back. So you're creating these conditions that will then increase the chance of tearing. So then that reinforces the practitioner, oh, birth equals tearing, and you know we need to manage it. And there's that, I think it's really interesting risk management, because there's this whole risk management culture in institutions, and it's all focused around you need to, as a practitioner, do all of these things to manage this, the risk, and the risk is the woman and the baby, when actually it's the other way around, that a lot of the things we are doing are the risks. And you know, the woman and the, just recognizing and respecting and facilitating physiology is risk management, because you're going to improve the outcomes by doing that. And I don't know how you, that's my mission, but I don't know how you get that across to people who are so caught up in this, if we don't do it this way, something awful will happen. And they've never seen anything. I mean, so some obstetricians have never seen a physiological birth. Mm-hmm. Some midwives have never seen a physiological birth. So working with students who are mostly placed in hospital settings, you know, I use a lot of movies from home birth and unassisted birth even, because it's sometimes even in home birth, there's a lot of fiddling happening. And they're watching it and they'll say to me, you'll be coming up to almost qualification, and that, well, I've never actually seen physiological birth from the beginning to the end. I haven't seen that. And that's really sad, because then how can they, if they don't experience it, how can they build trust in that process and support it?
Well, absolutely. And we're going to take another quick break, but when we come back, let's talk about how do we support that process in a system that isn't used to supporting it. We'll be right back. Breastfeeding, it may be natural, but that sure does not mean it's easy. It's a learning process for both you and baby, and like most learning processes, it takes a lot of trial and error. However, this trial and error can sometimes come with a lot of crying, and not necessarily only from your baby. Help lessen the crying and frustration by arming yourself with some solid knowledge. A great way to prepare for this is by taking the Simply Breastfeeding online class created by breastfeeding experts Cindy and Jana. In their class, you'll learn to recognize what your baby is telling you and how to meet your baby's needs starting in the very first hour after birth. You'll also understand the basics of breastfeeding and be able to return to them if you encounter difficulties, and you'll feel confident knowing the answers to most frequently asked questions. Lessen your anxiety and frustration and relax knowing you've got this. Go to birthful.com/simplybreastfeeding to learn more. And as a Birthful listener, you get 15% off if you use the code Birthful when you register. Go to birthful.com/simplybreastfeeding or click the link on the show notes to get you on your way. And we are back talking about protecting your perineum with Rachel Reed. So Rachel, knowing all these things, then how do we help the person giving birth to be able to have less of a tear and be able to push on her own within a system that is not quite trusting the hands-off process and that is used to having, you know, a 60% epidural rate. So 60% of the time they're dealing with moms who can't quite feel things all properly and are on their back or on their side and are being directed to push. So how can a mom, is it through birth plan? Is it, do you have any suggestions for them in terms of how to get more of a physiological pushing?
Yeah, it needs to come from the mothers. It needs to come from the consumers, I guess, is what the hospitals and practitioners will call them. So I know a little bit about the American system. It's, we've got public and private system here. So we've kind of got women in both birthing scenarios. And it's a little bit more difficult with private obstetrics, because you're employing that obstetrician and often they have their own set of how they do it, things and how they like things. So it's a good idea to find that out before you engage them as your care provider. If you can ask them, as you were saying, what's your episiotomy rate, what's your philosophy around birth, what's your normal practice for during birth, how many of your women have epidurals. It's a little bit easier here in the public system because you haven't got a specific obstetrician. You're looked after mostly by midwives, and you've just got to battle the hospital policies. But ultimately, nobody can do anything to you without your consent. So the consumer has a lot of power within those systems. They just don't know they have. And I would say for women who are birthing in an institution where they might not know who's going to be caring for them during labour, or their care provider may not be experienced with physiological birth, is to have a really strong birth plan and preferably have somebody like a doula who can advocate for you while you're in labour, because you can't do, when you're in labour, you need to be in that labour zone. You need to have your neocortex switched off. You can't be engaging in discussions about why it is that you don't want to be directed to push. But if you've got a birth plan, and I know women have successfully done that in hospitals here in Australia, it's things like, I do not want anybody to provide directions or talk whilst I'm pushing my baby out. I would like to take up a position that is comfortable for me during my labour and birth, and just really get it written down and have somebody who's at your birth who knows what you want, who can actually advocate for you, and just remind care providers if they start directing, on a birth plan she would like us to be quiet during this point, or
mm-hmm. And it's I find that, so we've kind of moved on past the episiotomy thing. Like, it is rare when it is done, and numbers have decreased incredibly, and it's surprising when somebody has it as a routine anymore, which is a good thing. But moms are still off the bat, sort of afraid of that, which it makes sense that you would be afraid of somebody cutting your vagina, your perineum. So, going through birth plans, and if they go to their care provider, they will probably say, oh no, we don't do episiotomies anymore. So maybe we need to get past that and go like, okay, we've sort of, we're done with that point. That's become mainstream. Then move to, like you're suggesting, the everybody be quiet, or because I find that even if a mom puts in her birth plan, I would like to push in any position that is comfortable to me, at that point, she does get sort of led to be in a reclining position or on a side position, definitely on the bed, even if she's doing hands and knees. And it, like you said, at that point, she should be just in labor. She shouldn't be trying to discuss a situation with anybody. And even having an advocate in a partner or in a doula that will say, these were her birth wishes, you can say that. But ultimately, the mom is the one that has to say, yes, that's what I wanted. I will do this again. Or, because sometimes they're so into it that they go, oh, no, this is fine. And that's as much as you can do, you know?
Yeah. And it is really, the research is that women, even when they have done childbirth education and prepared and decided that this is how their birth's going to be, that the environment they're then birthing can completely shift and shape that, as a lot of women have experienced. You know, you go in with these wishes and then, you know, that, for example, don't cut the baby's cord, and then, oh, the baby had to have the cord cut because it was needed to be resuscitated. There's a reason behind it. So, you know, the episiotomy, well, we had to because of whatever. So I think it's easier to write down what you do want and kind of give the care provider, not a huge, because they won't read, pages and pages.
Oh, no.
But just this is kind of setting the scene that I don't want people in the room that before I've been asked if they can come in the room, that I would like to birth on the floor. Maybe that's a way of getting off the bed and making it. What I found when I worked in a hospital, what I found really helpful was to shift the bed out of the way, and I just spread all my notes across the bed, so that was my space for writing things. And then put a crash mat on the floor and a bean bag, and set up a nest so that the woman would then either be in the toilet or the shower or in this nest. Mm-hmm. And then that's where birth happened, and we had a soft surface. And then if anybody else needed to come in and there was anything else going on, then we've already established this is where it's happening. And I can remember an obstetrician who didn't speak to me for 2 weeks because the obstetrician wanted to do a vagina examination and I wouldn't do one, and came in and asked the woman, and of course women will agree. So the woman agreed. And then I said, then that's then the obstetrician, I then said to the obstetrician, okay, well, you can do it here, because the woman was on the floor. And the obstetrician just looked at me, I can't do it there, she needs to get on the bed. And I said, well, you can do a vaginal examination on the floor, it's just the same. And I said, do you want me to do the vaginal examination? Because I can do a vaginal examination on the floor. And this obstetrician was furious, got on the floor, did the vaginal examination, went out of the room. The woman birthed very shortly after that, as I knew she would, but was so annoyed that I'd assumed that this obstetrician could get on the floor to do a vaginal examination. But you can, there's nothing, you can't, you can get on the floor and do things around a woman birthing if you need to. But we've got this cultural norm of putting women on beds, which is such an unnatural place to birth. You need, women seek the ground and want to be grounded, and to put a woman even on all fours, which is, you know, a good position anatomically, you know, physiologically for birth, it's put it up high. I actually make students get on the bed and pump it up and tell them to get on all fours and say, how do you feel? And they often feel really vulnerable and insecure because they're up on a height, you know, birthing. It's,
yeah. That, and that's the tough thing, because you go into a hospital room and the center of it is the bed, you know, it's a hospital. Hospitals have beds and that's what is there. So it's really hard to not just gravitate towards it, and make sure that everybody gets there really quick. And yeah. So, okay. So let's go into the things that do help decrease the risk of tearing so that these can go into that birth plan.
Okay.
That we were talking about.
So really avoiding interventions that increase the chance, things like Syntocinon for women who've previously had babies, not so much for women having their first babies, but Syntocinon interferes with the physiology anyway, so it'll interfere with the instinctive birthing response of the woman.
And I want to just interrupt for a second and say that Syntocinon is the same thing as Pitocin, which is how we know it more. But just, it's, you know, what is it? Chemical? No, it's not non-naturally occurring oxytocin.
Yes, the synthetic version of oxytocin.
There you go.
Which is actually, the molecules are exactly the same, but it functions very differently because it isn't released from the brain and there isn't that feedback that you would get with physiological, naturally occurring oxytocin. So, yeah, so avoiding that, avoiding directed pushing, avoiding any disturbance of the instinctive process during birth. So it's probably easier just to say to practitioners, I don't want anybody to speak unless I ask a question during my pushing. And that gets away from the, you know, I don't want you to be directed. Or say, I want silence during my pushing. So say what you want rather than what you don't want, perhaps will work better. So nobody kind of directing or telling the woman what to do. Her just tuned in and following. Not to be in a lithotomy.
Which is lying on your back or reclining?
Not lying on your back with your legs in those poles. That's the worst position for a tear. Also forceps will probably usually require an episiotomy in order to get the instruments in. And a Vontus, they often do that without an episiotomy now, but that can still increase the chance of tearing because of the downward pressure of the way in which they pull. Depends how good the practitioner is at how they use them in terms of tearing. So avoid squatting as the baby's born. So it's a great position to get the baby deep into the pelvis, but once the baby's head's starting to crown, to shift position, and women usually instinctively do that, but for people who are around women, if you've got a woman onto a squatting chair, I don't know whether you've got those in America, we've got these little squatting stools.
We don't. Often,
so we have them often in the birth rooms, and women will be encouraged to sit on those to bring the babies down, but then they need to be encouraged to get off them. If you've encouraged them to get on, you now need to encourage the woman to get off. So just for the woman to not be in that deep squat as the baby's head's crowning. And anything, you know, if she wants to draw her knees in, that's fine. So just listen to her body and to not feel that there's this rush to get the baby out. The slow birth of the head, we know, reduces the chance of tearing. So that, and it can be really frustrating for women to feel the baby's head moving down and then moving up and moving down and moving up. And just to remember, that's part of the process, that is protecting the perineum, and just let that happen. Just let the baby slowly move down and stretch those tissues slowly. What else for water? Water birth increases the chance of an intact perineum, and warm compresses as well. So not too hot, just kind of warm, like bath warm compresses just held against the perineum. And that often, as the baby's head's crowning, and women often really like that, because at that point it's really intense and they can kind of feel that support of the compress and the warmth. Other women just get off. So the woman needs to know that if she pushes that away, that's fine. She doesn't have to have it, but that can be offered at that point. So she could have that on the birth plan. And that's it, really. Just try and be undisturbed and tuned in, because your body is designed to birth and to protect the perineum. And the chances are 2/3 of women will have some kind of perineal damage. It's actually normal. And the perineum, so the vaginal wall is mucosal and heals like the inside of your mouth. You know, if you cut the inside of your mouth, it heals very quickly. And the perineum heals very quickly. And I guess that's another thing to consider is if you do have a tear, do you get it sutured? Do you leave it?
Right, because it is very common to tear. It's not like you're saying, it's, you know, your body heals quickly. So it's not something to be, you know, you can be a little bummed about it, but not incredibly super sad about it, because your body will heal. What I find more annoying and disturbing of the process is, you know, you might have a mom that did push, beautiful baby came out, and then ends up that because the baby came out so quick, she might have spent an hour being quote unquote repaired, you know, sutured back. And I understand that the baby probably flying out had something to do with the need for a lengthy repair, but it can disturb the process of this beautiful labor that was going great. You know, baby's out, and then suddenly she's up with her legs on the stirrups and people in her crotch sewing, and painfully so, uncomfortably so.
Yeah, and it's that those first moments with the baby, the first hour, is really important. Mm-hmm. And we need to respect that. And if a woman's not bleeding from her tear, it can wait. There's no massive urgency to repair a perineum. A woman can spend time with the baby before that then has to happen. And also there's a lot of, it tends to be standard practice or policy in most hospital settings that any second degree tear, so that's any tear that goes into the muscle layer, needs to be sutured. However, there's now good evidence. There's actually a Cochrane review that looked at the research and came up with a summary of the findings to say that there's not evidence to support, in terms of a second degree tear, there's insufficient evidence to say that you should suture or to say that you shouldn't suture. Hmm. And what they found was that you will have slower healing. So if you don't suture, you'll have slower healing, but by about 6 weeks, there isn't a difference, and that there's possible better overall feeling of well-being if left unsutured. And that's certainly what I found in the UK when we did team midwifery for women who were birthing wherever. We just went with them in hospital, home, cesarean section. And that's where my practices changed around suturing. And then this Cochrane review came out and just confirmed what I'd been seeing, which was that women who I cared for, who knew me a bit better because we'd had continuity care rather than just I looked after them for their labour, would be more likely to say, I don't want to be sutured. And I'd be like, oh, okay. And then I realised that those women's perineums were healing probably better than the perineums that were being sutured. So I just started to think about, well, why are we suturing if perhaps the outcomes are as good, if not better, if we don't suture? So the important thing for a wound to heal is that it's well aligned, so the edges fit together, and that there isn't bleeding. And if those two things are present, and most perineal tears will sit nicely together when the woman's legs are together, and she's not going to be walking around with her legs wide open after giving birth. She's going to be sitting. She's going to be doing a lot of spending time with her legs quite.
Yes.
Some women want to sit cross-legged immediately after giving birth for them. So her wound will heal, and only needs to be together for 24, 48 hours, and then the healing process is started. So we need to be having more discussions with women about, this is what your tear is like. What do you want me to do? It's sitting together nicely. It's not bleeding. We could suture it, which would mean it'll heal quicker. But what you've got to consider is when you're suturing, every hole that you make to put that needle in is another bit of trauma. And you've now got suture equipment in there. You've got suture material in there that can irritate. The number of times I've had to be called out to a woman's home just to cut the knot because it was irritating her perineum as it was healing. Really, suturing is more trauma. So you've really got to consider whether you need to do that. Is it bleeding? Do you need to bring it together to stop the bleeding? Or do you need to line it up because it's actually not well lined up? And I'm talking about second degree tears here, because significant tears, you know, third degree, fourth degree, really do need to be sutured. They need to be sutured in theatre by somebody who's very experienced and with good lighting, and because that's a real medical complication. But a second degree tear is not a medical complication. It's a very normal outcome from birth. And most women's perineums heal beautifully. And within, you know, a few days, I've got a lovely photograph from one of my clients.
she took a picture.
I took a picture because I was trying to explain to her to make a decision about suturing, and obviously she couldn't see. And I'm like, look, just give me a camera. Took a photograph so she could see, and she chose not to suture. And then she took a photograph for me a few days later when she was in the bath to show me how well everything was healed. And it's amazing.
That's fantastic. You have a before and after.
I have a before and after. And she kindly said, yes, you can use it for teaching because I'm sure nobody can recognize me from that photo. So that is an option. So women don't have to agree to being sutured. They can ask their practitioner, what kind of tear is it? Yeah. Is it sitting together? Is it bleeding? Can I leave it? Can I wait for an hour? Can you reassess in an hour? And just take a bit of... There are other methods of... I know a lot of the lay midwives here will use Manuka honey. Just to stick the edges together. And Manuka honey's got really good healing properties anyway and is used in wounds, in hospitals, in dressings. So that's another option. And some midwives use seaweed. Seaweed's quite sticky, just to stick the edges together and to aid healing. So there are other ways of bringing those two edges together. What I often find if there is tear, and most women I look after will have some trauma, even if it's just grazes or small tear. Mm-hmm. But what's very common is because women birth leaning forward, because that works so well, and that's often instinctively where they find themselves, that their tears... I don't see a lot of vaginal wall tearing because the pressure is at the front of the vagina, so it goes up the labia. So you'll sometimes get labial grazes or tears in the labia, which again heal well. But the woman needs to be careful if she has got labial tears on both sides to make sure that she, in the first 48 hours, keeps opening them so they don't fuse together.
Right.
Very important.
You do not want it to stick together.
No, you don't want it to heal together. That's
close
not up. Good.
No.
And it has happened to some women. So just to be mindful. And when you go to the loo, it's going to sting because of where the tears are. Yeah. And to use, you know, warm jug of water, pour it over yourself while you pass urine. Keep yourself hydrated so your urine's not concentrated, all those things. So yes, and suturing is often really traumatic for the women. As you say, they've just had this baby. They've usually had a lovely normal birth and they're wanting to get to know the baby and they end up in lithotomy with somebody, you know, suturing them for hours.
Yeah, and it's a different kind of pain and sensation because everything's very swollen. A baby just came out through there. Mm. And it's different from contractions in that there's not this rhythmic surge that comes and goes and that you're into and it, you know, has that rhythm. But it's a sudden sharp prick at some point, be it the needle or as the Novocaine, the numbing medicine, wears off, or depending on where it was, like it can be very jarring.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, and I also really appreciate you explaining the differences, what it means on first degree, second degree, third degree, fourth degree, because it's off the bat, you would think that that has to do with the length of the tear, and it doesn't have to do anything with the length of the tear, but the depth of it, how deep it goes into the tissues.
Yes. Yeah. And also you'll hear, you know, women be told, oh, I had to have 74 stitches. It's usually continuous. So it's just one long suture that is used. And we're getting a bit, well, We're getting a bit better in terms of putting less sutures in and not stitching the skin, because that's the most painful bit, and that's where the is unnecessary. If you bring the edges together on the inside, the muscle together, then everything else will sit together and heal, so you don't need to do the skin. So that's another option. If women want to be sutured, they could ask their care provider, can you please not suture the skin layer, because that's the most painful and unnecessary, and the evidence is that you shouldn't be suturing it. And just a note on, if a woman does have a really significant tear, third degree or fourth degree, when she comes to birth again, I mean, she's going to have a lot of fear around that. Is it going to happen again? And sometimes they're persuaded to then choose a cesarean section as an option for the next birth. There's the best bit of research on this was Australian, so it was looking at kind of the westernized birth system, I guess. And for women who had had significant tear, which was a third or fourth degree tear, there wasn't an increased risk that their next birth they would have another significant tear. So I guess that's an important thing for women to consider for their next birth, that they're not then likely to have that happen again, to have a very significant tear. What I have found is women who've previously had third or fourth degree tears will sometimes have a very small tear along the scar tissue. So like a first degree tear just into that scar tissue. And they might find that in pregnancy, massaging that scar tissue helps to loosen it and give a little bit more stretch in that area.
Yeah, and that makes sense because the scar tissue is not as stretchy as everything else around it.
So I have actually come across women who have, after the birth, said that the baby actually improved their perineum because they had a very tight little bit of tissue at the bottom of their vagina that was, whether it was left over from the hymen, I'm not sure, because I didn't have a good look beforehand. But the baby actually released that, and then subsequently they found that sex was less painful and that. So
interesting.
Sometimes positives.
The topography does change.
Definitely does.
Yeah. Rachel, finally to close, are there any, and then this is a little bit more at the outside of what we were talking, but tips for healing into the postpartum, not so much of exercises and Kegels and all that, or how to tone the perineum, but if they do have a tear, for that tear to heal better, do you have any suggestions?
Well, the body's pretty good at healing itself if you have good nutrition and rest and all that kind of thing. Onica is really good initially for bruising and swelling. Cold packs can help in the first few hours. I would stop within the first 12 hours using cool packs, because you actually want, because they reduce the blood flow to that area and you actually want blood flow there to help with healing. So that can help though with pain relief earlier on. Using a water jug so you're not getting urine on when you have a wee on the tear, or having a wee in the shower or wherever, you can dilute it. And it should start to feel better. It should be getting a little bit better every day. So just to keep an eye on, is it feeling a little bit better today than it did yesterday? And to look out for infection. So if it's starting to feel a bit more painful, if you're starting to feel a bit fluey, or that area is kind of smelling or not feeling right, then get that looked at. But generally, healing the perineum heals really, really well and quite quickly. So within 6 weeks, you know, even with sutures, you've got, it's pretty much, you can hardly see where the tear was.
Beautiful. Very good. Rachel, thank you so, so much for being here on the show. It's been a lovely talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm sorry, I almost forgot. If people want to know more about you and follow what you're doing, my goodness, how can they stay in touch and contact you?
Oh, probably through Midwife Thinking blog post and Facebook page. And that's all, really.
Perfect. Mighty ones, find the in-depth show notes for this episode at birthful.com, where you can also learn more about me, the show, Patreon member benefits, send me messages, and much more. I'm also on Facebook or Twitter as @birthful, so please do come say hi. And if you're looking to prepare for life with your newborn, then go to birthfulcourses.com and sign up. Do it now before baby arrives so you can get postpartum ready. This episode was produced by me and made possible by you, the Birthful Patreon supporters, and by the wonderful people at Canvas People and Simply Breastfeeding. To best support this podcast, support its sponsors, and get free goodies while you're at it. Use the code BIRTHFUL at canvaspeople.com to get a free 11x14 canvas, and go to birthful.com/simplybreastfeeding and use the code BIRTHFUL to get 15% off. The title song for this podcast is Vive Ace by Kevin McLeod, and the sponsorship song is Air Hockey Saloon by Chris Zabriskie. Find them both at freemusicarchive.org. Also, the Birthful Podcast is part of the Parents on Demand Network, a network of podcasts focused on parents. Download the free Parents on Demand app on Apple and Android for easy on-the-go listening. I'm Adriana Lozada. Please join me next week when I'll be talking to a mighty parent as they share their amazing story here at the Birthful Podcast. Thanks so very much for listening.